Welcome back, guys. This week we continue, as we have been, in the series entitled Spiritual Coaching or Train for Life. We're continuing in the second phase of coaching, which is how we understand and then help other men to understand the intersection points between their inner men and their outer worlds. We've often defined spiritual life as how my inner man responds to the outer world. And so we're considering some of the major response points. So there are small country intersections, if you will, and then there are major intersections where there's a lot of traffic. And I think in every man's life, some of those major intersections are the ones that we'll discuss today. We've already explored a few of them. We've explored work, which we will deal with in a little bit more detail this morning. And we've considered marriage and family. Those are certainly major intersections where a man's inner spiritual life responds to and intersects with his outer world. Today we're going to follow that up with the culminating topic of work, which is citizenship, and it will be self-explanatory once you get into the series. I hope you're enjoying this, guys. I hope you're having a chance to put some of these ideas into practice. Let me just remind you, it's not what you know, it's what you do with what you know. So we don't want to be armchair experts. Instead, we'd be better served if we were out on the field, occasionally making mistakes, occasionally making blunders at this, but learning from our mistakes and becoming better at responding to the real-life intersecting moments where our inner selves meet our outer worlds. So see you back here again next week, guys, and hope you have a blessed week. The class for wannabe comedians starts as soon as this study is over. I'd suggest you attend early and often. All right. So we only got a couple more weeks to go. Attendance is kind of light today. There's a number of guys that aren't here for one reason or another. So there'll be some catching up for some of them to do. But anyway, we've got two more weeks, this week and next week, in phase two, which is the intersection phase. Phase two of this spiritual coaching is where we look at how does my inner man intersect with the outer world. So we've looked at a few big, broad concepts, the things that most men in one way or another will deal with in life that are inner man, outer world intersections. So the first of them was work, and we're going to look at that in a little bit more detail this morning because we're going to break that down a little bit more specifically. As a matter of fact, everything that we have looked at thus far in the intersection phase is actually part of our work. It's part of our call. It's what we do. So who remembers what the two big components that we are given as our work responsibility are? You might want to say, how do we work? We work as... You know, even a wrong answer sometimes would be better than no answer at all. I can at least steer the bus when it's moving. When it refuses to leave the depot, it is impossible to steer. Okay, we were intended to be givers and... Oh, good guess. And instead we've become producers and takers. Let's talk about that for a minute in more specific terms. And I said we would break work down today, so we're going to call that providing. So most of you at one time or another have heard this phrase that men are often considered providers, and anybody want to take a guess what that second word might be? Protectors. Yeah, men are considered providers and protectors. And in a spiritual sense, then we also assume the responsibility of being prophets and priests. So those four P words, you could say, sum up a lot of our call to work. We're to be providers and protectors, to be prophets and priests. And we do that with a heart of giving and receiving. Remember I said we got to layer these ideas to get the full rich meaning that's there in them. How many of you have ever experienced provider fatigue? Has that ever happened to anybody here? How many of you have experienced, and I'm going to use the word work, and I'm going to use it in the context of provider. And what I mean by provider, and I've used that as a subset of work, is that the work that we do that is to provide, customarily we associate with going out and getting a J-O-B. And out of that J-O-B, what was that about? Huh? Out of that J-O-B, we're able to take some money, we're able to receive something, and then we in turn pass that downstream to those who need some of that. Have you ever experienced a lack of connection in your job, a lack of satisfaction? You ever felt like it was nothing but all work and no meaning? Now think about this, because this is profound, and it could change your attitude about work. If we are designed to be givers and receivers, and yet we find no satisfaction and no meaning in our work, what are the possibilities as far as what might be missing? Okay, these are all possibilities. Let's consider this. Have you ever heard the phrase, God is relational in nature? The correct answer is yes, because you've heard it here. So the only question then is, have you paid attention? God is relational in nature. And if God is relational in nature, and God is a worker at heart, then it follows suit that God is therefore relational in His work. That means His work is directed toward... toward us, toward people, toward those things that can constitute long-lasting relationships. So all of God's work, He views in the context of relationship. So if God is a relational being, and we are His kids, then what should that make us? Relational beings. So if we are relational beings, then all of our work has to be... relational in nature. The reason that many of us find a disconnect between what we do and meaning and significance is that we don't sense the relational nature of it. So here's the question that brings this home. Are you at times detached from the ultimate users of what you do? Are you at times detached from those who will truly benefit from what you do? Do you see the overall sense in which what you do matters to people? Now that's part one. You should be writing some of this down so that you can ask yourself these questions. And you know why you should do this? Because most of the men that you meet at one time or another will experience job dissatisfaction. Does anybody remember what this series is called? Yeah, that's part B of it, spiritual coaching, right? So if we are spiritual coaches, we're not here to absorb this for ourselves. We're here to absorb this so that we can go out and make a difference in the lives of other men. I think that it is a safe statement to make that many men, if not most men, experience at one time or another in their life job dissatisfaction, job disconnect, and ask the question, why in the world am I doing this? And at that point, it becomes nothing but a J-O-B. So the first reason that many of us experience a disconnect between what we do as providers and job satisfaction is that we don't sense the relational nature of it. But there's a second component to this, and this should convict every one of us. How often do you experience the thanks and the gratitude of others as the result of what you do? See, we are intended to be gracious givers. You can write that down too, not just givers. We are intended to be gracious givers. Who wants to take a swing at what that really means?
Joy.
With joy, with happiness. How do we give here at Morningstar? There you go. We give cheerfully. And we give because people deserve it. Not always. What is a gracious giver? What is grace? There you go. When we act as gracious givers, therefore it means that somebody didn't have to earn what we gave them, and grateful receivers, and that's the second component of it. We all need to be grateful receivers. Are you a grateful receiver? Because I firmly believe that many men experience job dissatisfaction, provider fatigue, simply because the people whom we are giving to are not grateful receivers. Would you say that that has been true at one time or another in your life? That the people that you have been pouring your life into were not grateful receivers? As a matter of fact, we can sum that up with the simple question, what have you done for me lately? Right? Isn't that the attitude of some people? Isn't that the attitude of some companies? So if we are not both of these components, gracious givers, grateful receivers, then somewhere in the line we have failed. So is it possible, and remember I said both of these constitute our work mandate, is it possible that there are people in your life that are experiencing provider fatigue because you have not been a properly grateful receiver? That's a contemplative question for each of us to take away. It is possible that you have actually robbed someone of their experience to be satisfied in their work only because you have failed to be a properly grateful receiver. All right, does that all make sense? Y'all hate me now because I've told the truth about what this really is like? Okay, so God is relational in nature. Take that away. All of our work has to be relational. We're looking at this in the context of being providers because when it comes to the second and the third phase, for the most part, we sense a little bit more connection and meaning. The second phase of life, we said, was most of us find one significant relationship, a relationship with a spouse, and that is a relationship uniquely designed to provide giving and receiving opportunities. So you're going to meet with men who maybe aren't yet married. What's your counsel to them? Because you're going to be saying, well, I'm going to meet with somebody and I'm going through this material and we're going to get to something like this and they're not married and so, well, that's awkward. Stay away from that. Is that your counsel to those who aren't married yet? Stay away from that. Get a dog instead. So that you can be a more grateful receiver, right? All right, well, what is our counsel to guys? See, if I'm not married and the expectation is that one day I may be married, what are you going to say to me? Do you have anything to say to guys who aren't married?
You don't know all that junk you're laughing about, like the money and the position and whatever. Look at the relationship you're going to have. Do you feel that you perceive that it's a good relationship or are you just doing it for other reasons, maybe? But the girls, a lot of times, younger, they go out, guys can get a nice car, stuff like that. You got to get beyond the superficial.
Yeah, by the time we are owners of a few gray hairs, we should have a few pieces of wisdom about what it means to be in a marriage relationship if we've been married for a while. So we often ask the question, well, how many of you have found marriage to be different than what you expected it to be when you got married? And we all chuckle at that and we all acknowledge that's true. But here's a more important question. How many of you, prior to getting married, received a lot of good, solid advice about what to expect and what marriage was like and how to prepare for it? How many of you in this room can say you did? One, Anybody else? It's okay. I mean, this would be a great chance to disprove my theory. Really. You could make me look foolish right now. Just put your hand up. Most of us don't. What does that tell us as potential coaches? There is a big need. There is a huge need. And it is not adequately addressed, and it's not addressed. Now, think about this. Where are we sitting? Are we sitting at the ballpark? Are we sitting at the bar? Where are we sitting? We're sitting in church. What does that tell us? The need isn't even being adequately addressed in church. Now, some churches do it better than others. But here's the thing. There's a limit to what... Well, okay, if we're going to have marriage training, and remember, your coach is here, so I want you to hear this through the mind of a coach or a shepherd. Whose job would it be to help young men understand what it means to be married? Mind of the typical guy walking in the church. Whose job would that be? It's what?
It's your job.
Yeah. Well, let's assume that every church, thankfully, doesn't have a Glenn. And there are many churches around the country that right now are breathing a sigh of relief.
So who, the town is raising your kids, you know, school, or bringing the church, the Sunday school teacher, pastor, whatever.
Yeah, and in a church setting, I think many people assume that the pastor will do that. How many of you feel qualified to speak into another man's life about the pitfalls of marriage?
I think you feel you're qualified to do it, but you don't want to have somebody come back at you and say, well, that was all very good. You know, you're not going to tell them anything they want to know about what went on in my marriage or my life. I don't have a problem doing that at all with anybody, but everybody's different, and they're going to go and try to do some of the things you said, and it's going to backfire on them.
Okay. Let me ask it a different way then. That's a valid point. I think there is a difference between our own personal advice, we'll say, on the one hand, and general principles that we could say are God's wisdom for relationships. So this is going to sound like the typical, like I'm setting you up, like this is the church answer that I expect, but it's not. How many of you have really put God's principles, not specific rules, but His general principles into practice and found them to be wanting? Do you understand what I'm saying? See, for the most part, we can't say, well, you know, I really engaged it God's way and it doesn't work. Does anybody say that's true in your life? I really did it God's way. I tried it God's way. And you know what? It doesn't work. Could we have at least a modicum of trust in this so that we could take principles from this book, understand how they apply to marriage, and be able to share them with the next generation? You understand what I'm saying? It's one thing for me to say, and I get right where you are with that. It's one thing for me to say, let me tell you how to do this in your marriage when it's just based on my unique experience. But I'm married to my wife, unfortunately. And she never listens to this. It's all good. I'm married to my wife. But she's just one person among many. And so I have no idea if the things that I already know don't work in my marriage will or will not work in your marriage. But if I take general scriptural principles and begin to put them to the test in my own marriage and then begin to offer them to other men, there's a good likelihood that they're going to work. In addition, as a coach, you're not just a dispenser of information. We talked about this early on. And I'm hammering home this idea of what we do when we leave this teaching, because we're almost done here. Aren't y'all glad? We only got a couple more weeks and we're going to be done with this spiritual coaching series. Well, if you aren't all glad, I'm starting to be glad, right? I'm looking forward to the end of this. But when we go out there and when we start to work with other people, we're not just dispensers of information. What is a coach? You're going to be out there with them. You're not going to be in their living room when they're having a fight, but you're going to be meeting with somebody regularly. You're going to have an opportunity to discuss this. And unlike the way we're going through this in a series, in a very linear way, the people that you meet with are going to come back to these same themes again and again. As a matter of fact, here's one of the ways that you can tell that a man is ready for deep conversation. It's when he begins to open up and talk about the intersection issues. So what do we say that the several intersection issues are that we've talked about so far? A man in his work, a man in his marriage, a man in his family. Do those three things consume the bulk of your time? You and your work, you and your marriage, you and your family. Would you say that they consume a majority of your waking hours? If you lump the three of them together, yeah. If it, what's that?
Definitely in the 90s.
Okay. Most of you are looking confused, like you're not sure. What do you do all day long? Are y'all on the golf course? Well, I'm doing what I do. I don't know. Yeah. So when a man starts to talk openly about these three issues, he's started to get serious about opening up and doing life with you. What are the things that guys use as a diversion from getting serious? What do we talk about when we don't want to get serious? We talk about all that stuff. And so as coaches, what then is our strategy? Yeah, it's steer them back into this. Tell me a little bit about these intersecting issues in your life where your inner man meets your outer world. Help me to understand how you're doing there or not doing there. Okay, so today we're going to move beyond all that. And incidentally, does anybody have any questions or comments on what we've talked about so far? Let me give you a homework assignment right now. Yeah, look at y'all. You're all eager to write, but I know the truth. You aren't going to do anything with it anyway. You're just all trying to impress me right now. I would like to, at the end, maybe the last week that we are together in this series. Well, thank you, Brother Dave.
Yeah, you're going to make another pot and bring it up here.
Bring your questions. Bring your real questions. In other words, let me paraphrase it and put it in your words. I don't think we talked enough about this, Glenn. I'm really confused about this. Or do you forget about that over there? Whatever it is. Bring your questions, comments, or things that might facilitate some additional understanding. Because I can think I did a reasonably proficient job at getting points across, and maybe I've done a terrible job. Your questions are going to tell me that. So we'll take a week, and we'll really dialogue about some of the things that maybe I've forgotten to deal with that are really issues. Maybe things that the men that you have conversations with in your work talk about, ask about, and we haven't covered it all. All right, so the three components, four components of our overall work, and we're going to distinguish what we did in week one, work from rest. So our work consists of what we do as providers, protectors, prophets, and priests. I'm going to have to put another parenthetical statement in here. Remember that as providers, we are not just providing for the physical. Remember the week when we talked about marriage and I said that there are many men who say, well, I bring home a paycheck, what more does she want? What are the other ways in which we need to be providers? Emotional. Spiritual, which is a combination of emotional and probably intellectual. What am I putting into this other person? So it's not enough if I'm bringing a paycheck home so that they can have a roof over their head and food to eat. If I'm not investing in their inner selves, if I'm a spiritual coach, where should it start? At home. If I can't practice this at home, if I'm not doing any of it at home, then I probably need to reprioritize. So maybe the first place, if you're not already doing this, where you become a more comprehensive provider is taking some of the things that hopefully we've talked about and you've learned in this multiple week series, and you're going to try it at home. You're going to try it with your own sons and daughters, with your wife. And I don't care how old your sons and daughters are. They may not even be at home anymore. But so long as you have connection with them, so long as you have any contact with them, you have the opportunity to continue to invest in them. All right, so that was the provider, protector, prophet, and priest. Do we have any questions about the prophet and priest? We've talked about this two-part plan that we have for, but I don't know that we've talked about it recently. Does everybody get that? Well, let's make sure. What's a prophet? And gives to? Okay, so the prophet is the one who takes God's word and gives it to the people. How does that apply to us?
We're instructing our kids.
Okay.
We're not instructing our wives, the same as we would be spiritually. So that's, we're reading the Bible together, praying together with our spouse or our kids. That's how we do that.
And it has to be done creatively because no two people are the same. That means that Josh's wife and your wife are not the same. They don't receive things the same way. That means that Josh and you are not the same. That means you don't learn the same way. So you need to understand who you are as a unique human being and how you can best get principles of God into your life in ways that you can then share with other people in ways that they will receive. Now, isn't that a lot of links in that chain? That's why I can't stand here and do anything but make some very general recommendations about how this will work, because I don't understand your life, I don't understand your schedule, I don't understand how you learn best, and I don't understand anything. I don't even understand my own wife, so I certainly don't understand yours. All right. We're going to look at the final phase of our call to work today, and that's what I've called citizenship. So in the minds of most men, if they got the first three components right, they're a good provider, they're a good husband, and they're a pretty decent dad. If they get those three right, in the minds of most men, they're golden. If there's anything left over in the way of budget, in the way of time, in the way of any other resources, they can then use that for themselves. But we've got one more component that God calls us to. He invites us to become citizens of a new community, a new country, a new kingdom, He calls it. And as that, we have citizenship responsibilities. So let's take a look at one scripture. Actually, one story, two scriptures. To really bring this home. So we're going to turn over to Numbers. 32nd chapter, and I'm just going to begin to read because there is a lot to read here. It's up to you if you want to just turn there and then mark it so that you can come back to it and read it later a little bit more thoughtfully and slowly. Now the people of Reuben and the people of Gad had a very great number of livestock, and they saw the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, and behold, the place was a place for livestock. So here's where we are. Moses and the gang do the 40-year traipse through the desert. All the old generation, for the most part, dies off. We've got a new generation here. They're very shortly going to cross over the Jordan. So they're camped in a region that's, give or take, directly across from Jericho. So they're poised at this point opposite of the land that is supposed to be yours. But several of these tribes, the leadership of these tribes, looks at the land where they are and says, this is really choice real estate. And it makes some observations here about why. It says they have a very great number of livestock, and they saw that the land was a place for livestock. So these are educated men, educated according to what they have to do for a living, and they say, this is ideal territory. And so they go to Moses and they say, look, I know that The land that God has given us is on the other side here. But we have already dispossessed the people that are here. And this is perfect pasture land. This has got everything that a shepherd could ever want. Would God mind if we had this ground? And so here's what. But Moses said to the people of Gad and to the people of Reuben, "Shall your brothers go to war while you sit here? Why will you discourage the heart of the people of Israel from going over into the land that the Lord has given to them? Your fathers did this when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. For when they went up the valley of Eshcol and saw the land, they discouraged the heart of the people of Israel from going into the land." So what's Moses' fear? Well, if you guys stay here, that reduces us in numerical strength. Then there's going to be some wars on the other side of the river. And we're going to need men for the wars. And if you guys all stay on this side, where the land's already yours and the situation is ideal, in other words, if you say to yourself, "Well, I got mine," it's your job to figure out how to get yours. If you say that, you're going to dishearten the rest of this community. And they're going to want to go get the land that's theirs on the other side of the river because you already got the land on this side of the river, so there's nothing here for them. But they're going to be demoralized because their brothers are not going to go across the river with them to fight. This is going to be kind of like where we were 40 years ago, where some of you wanted to say, "Yeah, let's go," but most of you said, "Nah, let's stay." So Moses is saying, and we're not going to have a repeat of that. So then he goes on. "Surely none of the men who came up out of Egypt on that day," and he swore saying, "from the 20 years old and upward, shall see the land that I swore to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, because they have not wholly followed me, none except Caleb and Isaac." And the Lord's anger was kindled against Israel, and he made them wander in the wilderness for 40 years until all the generation that had done evil in the sight of the Lord was gone. And behold, you have risen up in your father's place, a brood of sinful men. I love Moses' honesty here. Okay, so your dad's died, so what? You think it's your job to step into their place as chief sinners among us? Chief rebels among us? Weren't your fathers enough? "For if you turn away from following him, he will again abandon them in the wilderness, and you will destroy all this people." So what's Moses' answer to their question? What does it seem?
"You already got yours, so let's help them get theirs."
Yeah. "When they came near to him and said, 'We will build sheepfolds here for our livestock and cities for our little ones, but we will take up arms ready to go before the people of Israel until we have brought them to their place.'" So if you were to sum this up, if we stop right there and it goes on, and I'd suggest that you read this whole chapter if you have the time. And we're going to turn over to the first chapter in Joshua right now because the two are linked. So what you're seeing here in Numbers is the before the story. What you're going to see in Joshua is the story as it plays out. So what is Moses' answer to them? What is Moses' explanation to them about their proposition? Yeah, if you look out, if your whole goal in life is to look out for you, and as soon as you have what you need, you figure that your mission in life is done, then you have failed the rest of this community. So in that sense, first off, he puts us in a broader community. But that means your job in life is not done as soon as you have yours. That you are part of a community and you cannot consider yourself a successful Christ follower if you have yours, but all around you, you see people that don't have theirs. Now that doesn't mean that we have an imbalancing of wealth. It doesn't mean the wealth distribution occurs that we hear so often in the news. It doesn't negate the other person's responsibility to do their part. I want you to hear that, just so we're clear on that. But what it does say is this, and we're going to get into this a little bit more comprehensively in a few minutes. God has given to each one of us unique talents and gifts. If you use your unique talents and gifts, and this is okay, to help yourself, and I say that's okay, I want you to understand that. If you use your unique talents and gifts to help yourself, to provide for your family, to provide for your wife, but you stop there and take your talents and gifts home, then you have failed the community. You understand? If we look at resources, if we look at gifts as divided equally to bless the whole body, and you take your gifts and the only thing you do with them is use them to help yourself, then you haven't fully blessed the community. And God holds us liable individually for that. God holds us liable corporately within a church if we do that. So if a body of us keep our gifts to ourselves and we keep feeding inward and inward and inward and we never look out into the community, then God holds us liable for that. And you see the way He described the people as sinful. So here's what God is saying. If our job as workers stops in our own minds, with our families, with ourselves, with our wives, then we are in fact missing the mark, which is a definition of sin. So it's not an option in God's mind. If we are to be citizens, we have citizen responsibilities in the kingdom of heaven. Alright, so here it is played out. First chapter of Joshua starts at, we begin with verse 10. And Joshua commanded the officers of the people, pass through the midst of the camp and command the people, prepare your provisions, for within 3 days you are to pass over this Jordan to go and to take possession of the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess. So this is it. It's finally happening. 40 years, new generation. Sheep pens on the other side are already built. Families over on the other side for those that are going to stay on the other side of the river. That's all taken care of. And to the Reubenites and the Gadites and to the half-tribe of Manasseh, these are the ones that chose to take real estate on the other side of the Jordan, on the east side of the Jordan, Joshua said, remember the word that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, saying, the Lord your God is providing you a place of rest and will give you this land. Your wives, your little ones, and your livestock shall remain in the land that Moses gave to you beyond the Jordan. But all the men of valor among you shall pass over, armed before your brothers, and shall help them until the Lord gives rest to your brothers. All right. So this is it. This is the final component of your work. So this is easy to remember. The four components of your work are you work as a provider, providing something of value to other people. You do that so that you are able to receive things that you will in turn use to provide for your family. Those three, plus I am an ongoing and active participant as a citizen in the kingdom of heaven. So long as you were not a believer, maybe you were exempt from that. If you're a believer, God says you're really not exempt from that. Now here's the thing. Sometimes people who aren't believers really put us to shame at this. Right? There are people, we can't say that this is strictly something that believers do. We see people in the world who get involved. And when I say in the world, I don't mean that in a negative way. I simply mean it that they are not yet followers of Christ. They're not in relationship with Christ, and yet they're out there giving and doing. They see the needs in the world around them. Now, what's the trap that a lot of believers fall into? We selectively see needs that will advance a particular agenda, and we ignore many of the others. So here's a question. Was Jesus discriminant about the way that He blessed those that came to Him for help? Did He say, well, I see where you're going in your life, and I don't think I'm going to bless you. I'm not going to give you anything, because you might squander it. See, that doesn't happen. You'd never see that side of the story. Jesus says to those who come to Him for help, here. And so our job is not to advance an agenda with what we give. Our job simply is to become involved. And what happens when we become involved? People are drawn to that. People stand up and take notice. When we give, how do we give? Besides cheerfully, I had to qualify that. We give graciously and receive gratefully. If we carry that through into our citizenship responsibilities, that means when we go out into the community, beyond our kids, beyond our wives, we're still compelled by the love of God to give graciously, not because people have earned it. That's our citizenship responsibility. Y'all bored? Really, nobody's saying anything. We need Jim here. This may be the first morning when I'd have to admit I almost had missed Jim. So here we have it at the top of page 32. In the kingdom of heaven, I am my brother's keeper and my sister's too. And for that reason, my responsibilities as a provider and protector, prophet and priest, move into the kingdom. A few typos there. I have the privilege and the responsibility to look out for, love, nurture, and even challenge, rebuke those who are appropriately needy. So then we're faced with the next question. What do I have to give? Do you know what you have to give? Does each of you know what you have to give? Do you know who you are? Remember several weeks ago, I gave us all an assignment. It was to write your own position and purpose statement. To use the words of Paul, the words of Peter as sort of a help to just jumpstart your own thinking, but that you would craft your own statement of position and purpose. Now, how many of you actually did that? Three? Four? Okay. Would anybody be bold enough to want to share that? Because here's the thing, if you don't know who you are, then how are you going to know if you were the right one to engage that opportunity? Hey.
To grow in abundance, grow for the glory of God.
Is that yours? There you go. And you would begin that with I, Marcos, or however you would like to introduce yourself. Right? Okay. Oh, I was volunteering you. You didn't really volunteer, did you? I see.
One is everyday work, partner by trade, using honesty and integrity to support God's work and everything I do every day.
There you go. Okay. Can that help to guide what you do and don't do? All right, well, let's turn down or move down to this third point. As a citizen, I've been given specific gifts, which I've been called to use fully, both to serve those in my country, in other words, other believers, and those not yet my countrymen. I can remain ignorant of my gifts, or I can elect to learn about them. So let's stop right there, and we're going to walk through the three basic texts on spiritual gifts in just a moment. I don't think I've ever done that here, but we're going to do that. But how many of you already know what your spiritual gifts are as well as your human talents, skills? How many of you can be really clear when you look at a need and you say, that's me, that's not? How about in the church? How many of you are as clear in the church? So most of us know in our work, okay, that's not me. Our J-O-B work, I mean. The thing we go off to do somewhere. Most of us know what we are and what we aren't there. But how about in the church? Do we know who we are and who we aren't? In other words, amongst the citizens of our own country. And then when we look out, I mean, every day, think about how many opportunities you drive past every day. Just think about it. Think about the needs. If you drive 10 miles to work, how many needs do you think you drive by? More than you could imagine, more than you and I could ever know, right? If you pass 100 people in a day, how many needs did you see? Thousands, maybe, if you multiply each person by the number of needs that they have? So how do we know? How does any of us know? Let's take a look at these texts on spiritual gifts. Sure. And that means that in the context of what we do to renew ourselves on a daily basis, and people call this stuff like devotions, and there's all this stuff that's just this Christian lingo that we throw around. And I have to spend my daily quiet time, or whatever that is. Listen, let's look at it a different way. And I know that if we used these phrases for 10 weeks, they would start to be just new Christian lingo. I get that. But what if we all had a time every day of renewal and refocusing? And therefore, when I go into this word, I'm looking to renew and restore what in me may have been wounded, but I'm also looking for reminders of specifically what my purpose is and what my gifting is and where that fits into the world at large. So do you notice that in your reading? Or are you just going there because somebody told you to have a quiet time? Not really. I mean, does that be, or do you have a purpose before you ever sit down to spend time with God, or stand up, or however you spend time with God? I don't know. Maybe you do it on one of those inverted things where you hang by your feet for 20 minutes. I don't know where you spend time with God or how. It might be tough to read upside down, but
I think one of the bigger challenges application. I think a lot of times in my study, I'm doing more absorbing than I am necessarily taking it and applying it to my life. So for me, I think that's one of my biggest struggles. I don't feel like I apply it. I feel like I got it here.
This is where I wish we had a whiteboard. So why don't you do yourself a favor here? We're going to have a little bit of a conversation because you brought out a good point. So you struggle with applying what you've learned. Incidentally, as you coach men, you're probably going to encounter people that have the exact same problem. So if we can sort through this and understand how to move beyond this, we've learned something that we can use to help other men. Do you understand what I mean? What other problems do you have with that quiet time and connection? Is there any? The renewal time. Well, apparently you're the only one here in the room with a problem. I don't know what's up with that, but apparently that's it. Either that or nobody else wants to talk. Anybody have suggestions for our brother Dan here about the application thing? Does anybody else have that problem? I read stuff, I see stuff, I learn stuff, but I'm not sure how it intersects with the life I live or what I should do with it.
You've got to be not afraid to make mistakes.
Okay. How about fellowship? It's one of the gifts that we in the church give to each other. Do you ever have conversations with other men about, this is what I know, this is who I think I am, but I'm not sure that I understand what to do with who I am and what I know? Do you ever have those conversations with anybody?
From time to time, yeah.
Are they helpful?
Yeah, I think so.
So maybe part of renewal time is actually scheduling regular conversations with other people. Is the regular scheduling part of your routine for renewal?
Scheduling, no.
See, what if that is it? What if we've missed part of that overall comprehensive renewal idea that I need to spend some time alone with God, but that if other people in my church community have gifts that are complementary to my own, then maybe I need to sit down with some of them who can help me to understand where my place is. It's kind of like if you're navigating. other people provide some additional fixed known points that help to guide you so that you can navigate.
Or maybe like after a sporting event or this or that, you sit down and have coffee or go out to eat, and you talk about, you know, how the game was or how this was or something else. Or like after church, you sit down here and chat that way. Have some coffee and talk about it or do something like that.
Yeah.
Well,
that's part of what John, I think, is trying to encourage when we look at the groups that meet to discuss sermon notes throughout the week. Well, this is what we learned, some big ideas, but what do we do with it? Does anybody else experience what Dan is describing? At least to a limited degree.
I think maybe sometimes you might read it, you might experience it, this and that for yourself, and then I've already noticed that for myself, been someplace and did something and you wanted to help somebody do something, but maybe you're busy or that, and later on say, gee, I really could have used that application there, but I missed the opportunity, so you look for it to happen again.
Hmm.
Or maybe you're more aware of it later. Maybe it skipped past you once.
All right, let's turn over to the fourth chapter of Ephesians. Taking off, Josh?
Yeah, I can't.
Okay, I understand. Thanks for your honesty. Might be the most genuine feedback I've gotten all morning. There's a lot here to read. Well, let's just start at the beginning. I, therefore, a prisoner for the Lord, urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you have been called. Let's stop right there. What's our call? That's tied to that position and purpose statement that I've asked you to write. That's your call. It's somewhat unique and specific. With all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another, in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. All right, so that's within the kingdom. And then he goes on to say, there's one body and one spirit, just as you were called to the one hope that belongs to your call. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all. But grace was given to us, each one of us, according to the measure of Christ's gifts. Therefore it says, when he ascended on high, he led the hosts of captives and he gave gifts to men. Jump down to verse 11, and he gave the apostles and the prophets and the evangelists and the shepherds and the teachers. Does everybody understand what every one of those terms means? How about an apostle? Now, first off, let's look at who these gifts are given to. They are given to individuals, but they are given to individuals within the church to either build up the church or, in some cases, actually start branches of the church. We'll call it that. So these are internal gifts. Some people have gifts that are more focused on what's out there. Some people have gifts that are more focused on what's in here. All right, so an apostle is, by this definition, and interestingly, our definition has to expand. An apostle, by the definition of those who used it at that time, was one who had seen Jesus Christ personally and was in his presence. Paul is the notable exception in that his appearance, his seeing Jesus, was that vision on the road to Damascus. That's what he believes qualifies him as one of the apostles. But beyond that, it's people who have been with Jesus, and what was their job? It was to go out and start communities of believers. And then the prophets, we've talked about that, people who hear from God and speak to men. The evangelists are those who specifically call individuals into relationship with God. And then these, the shepherds and the teachers, care for the flock. How many of you are teachers here? How many of you have ever thought of yourselves as teachers here? Shepherds? Ron, you're not sure. Threw your hand up like maybe, maybe not. Well, there you go. We've talked about what a shepherd is. In the context of coaching, what's the difference between training and shepherding? Okay, let me ask it a different way. For how many of you is this statement true? It takes me much longer to learn how to do what I know than to learn something. Have you ever heard something on a Sunday morning? You say, oh, I know that now. How many of you spent the next 10 years trying to learn how to live that out on a daily basis? See, a teacher's job is easy. A teacher says, this is what it says, this is what you should do with it. The shepherd's job is much harder. The shepherd gets down there next to the sheep and says, okay, and this is how we do it today. And this is how we do it this minute. And this is how we're going to do it next minute. So teachers have the easy... Look, this stuff right now, what I'm doing, this is easy. Really is. Helping people to live it out a day at a time is hard. Walking with them through the frustrations and the mistakes is hard. That's what I'm calling all of you to do. Because I'd like the easy part. I want you to go through the hard part. All right, and we've already been through this specific text, so we know the outcome, the end game that Christ has in mind. The end game is that we're all united, that we're all built up, that there is unity and complete understanding. And so what he's saying is, in every church community, these gifts are present. And they're present for the benefit of all. So, if you say, I've got mine. I've got what I need in order to provide. I've got what I need in order to care for my family. I've got what I need in order to have a good relationship with my wife. I've got mine. But I don't really care yet if you have yours. Then you're taking the gift that God has given you and you're just hoarding it. That you cannot be complete, satisfied, and whole as a follower of Christ unless you are engaged and giving. It's part of our work. All right, 1 Corinthians 12, 1 through 13. I'm sure we're not going to read all that. We'll start at verse 4. Now there are varieties of gifts, but the same Spirit, and there are varieties of service, but the same Lord, and there are varieties of activities, but the same God. I'm going to spend some time there. There are varieties of gifts, but the same Spirit. What does that say to you? How does that establish unity? How does that dispel a competitiveness or a comparativeness that we sometimes engage in the body? Have you ever felt like some things in the church are more important than others? Just be honest. Yeah, have you ever felt like the church could do without me, but it couldn't do without, oh, I don't know, John? He's not here, so we can talk about him. It's cool. Let's take advantage of it. What does this say? The same God that gave John the gifts that God gave John has given each of us in this room the gifts that He has chosen to give us. There are varieties of service, but the same Lord. In other words, there are a number of different things that you can do with the gift that you've been given. So each of us has been given different gifts by the same God. We're going to take those gifts and we're not even going to do the same thing. Two of us have the same gift. We're going to do completely different things with the same gift. But we're honoring the same God. So you use your gift here. Maybe I use my gift out there. You use your gift to help students. Maybe I use my gift to help adults. Whatever it is. There are varieties of activities, but the same God who empowers them all in everyone. So, different gifts, same God. Different service? Same plan from the same Lord? Different activities? Same God who empowers them all and everyone. What would the end result of all that be? There it is. All the needs should be met. If we're each doing our part, and what do? We sometimes say, well, I really need to be more like that, because that's the way apparently people in the church need to be. And that's not true. Because when we all start to compare ourselves to each other and try to become like each other, there's a whole host of needs that never get met. Just think about that. Do you ever feel like forced into a mold of being somebody in the church that maybe you're not? Do you ever feel that there's certain things that you need to do and look like and all that? Is it possible that there are needs that don't get met because of that? I'm going to let you read the whole list of gifts here. It's a good list here, but we don't have time to read it all. Let's turn over to the Romans 12 text. If you have never done a side-by-side study where you move from one of these texts to the next, these three major texts on gifts, you really should do that. Incidentally, Brother Dave, I want you to know that I would gratefully receive if you would cheerfully give.
I thought it was going to fall back up last time.
I miss the old days when there were just coffee pots and you could walk over and just pour a cup of coffee. I
smile, we have no idea.
Oh, you know what? I don't want to know, and I'm going to thankfully receive, Dave.
Something out of coffee.
Oh, backpack. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, I appeal to you therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. All right, in the context of what we're talking about, which is work as the overall expression of my willingness to give in all areas of life, how does this compare my, what does this say about my work? Calls it worship. Just, your work is one of the predominant ways in which you worship God. How you do your work. The attitude that you bring to your work. The desire that you have to bless people. It is one of the predominant ways that you honor God and worship God. As a matter of fact, and if Larry were here, he would be so hurt by this. What we do on Sunday morning, while it is important, is not necessarily the predominant way that we were intended to worship. How many of you could see yourselves singing for 8 hours a day? Do I hear five? How many of you can see yourselves taking the best of who you are and the best of what God is giving you and pouring that into what you do every day? Is that a connection? Of course it is. And in that you honor God, because it's God who's given us the gifts. It's God who's given us the opportunities. And all we are doing is simply taking advantage of what God has given us, both put into us and what's out there around us to do. And we're bringing our best to that. And that is worship. All right, let's move down here. Verse 4, for as in one body we have many members, and the members do not all have the same function, so we, though many, are one body in Christ, and individually members of one another. So if we are individually members of one another, this is the last time I'm going to say this. If you haven't gotten it by now, there's no hope. There is no room for, I've got mine, and now it's your problem to figure out how to get yours. Your work is not completed until we are all whole. Remember what it said in the first text? The one in Ephesians, till we are all built up into the fullness of Christ? Right now, are you built up into the fullness of Christ? You might feel like you are right this second. 5 hours from now, will you be? So the work is never ending. The work goes on. And for the rest of your life, God gives you the opportunity, God gives me the opportunity to invest in each other. So that's the final component of our work. We do that best when we discover the gifts that God has given us. All right, we're going to wrap up with... All right, let's talk about this in the context of coaching. Move down beyond the my gifts coupled with my resources are one of God's chosen ways. In the next paragraph, in this new kingdom of which I've become a citizen, each generation is responsible for teaching the next how to be followers of Christ in the place and time which they live. Each generation fears that the next will not be ready. Each generation struggles with releasing control, or at times fails to train and teach and prepare the next generation to seize the opportunities which are there. One of the best ways that you can coach people is invite them to help you in whatever you do to serve and to give. This is really difficult because in the lives of most men, there's this phrase that we use a lot. By the time I can explain it to you and help you to understand how to do it, I could have done it myself. How many of you have ever fallen prey to that and said, you know what? I think I'm just going to do it myself. What if we're failing in our work by doing that sometimes? And I don't mean that there's never a time when, yes, there are times. There really are times when you just got to get it done. When it has to be done in a half an hour and it would take an hour to train somebody, it's obvious. Just go do it. But if your whole life is scheduled so that everything has to be done by you and done in an urgent rush, and there is never any time to let somebody else step in and work alongside of you and make mistakes, how will anyone ever learn? I'm telling you, churches fall apart this way. Churches that begin well fall apart because at some point in time there is no trust established. And you've heard me say this before, but anything worth doing well is... Well, I'm going to let you finish it. Anything worth doing well is... Oh my word. Really? Is worth doing badly until you learn how to do it well. Because none of us starts out doing anything well. So if you want to develop other people, there's no choice but to occasionally risk allowing something to be done less than well.
In that paragraph, it's really a direct relationship. Last week, family and inheritance, passing your ideals, whatever, to your kids so they can do that. Same thing within the church. You're passing on your gift or your talents to someone else so they can then pass it.
I know. I mean, that's the way it is. You know, come back next week for 5 minutes, okay? I'll see you again next week. Yeah, and what you said is extremely important. I hope you understand what you said. We pass our values and principles along. We don't pass along methods. The methods that you use in this generation may fail in the next generation. And we can see that in churches, we can see that in businesses. Businesses that fold many times are businesses that compromised on their values and principles, but retained their methods. Methods don't work generation over generation over generation all the time. But values and principles will serve us well. So in our coaching, if you're in doubt about what to share, share the why more than the how. We all need to share a certain amount of how. I mean, it's good when you're working with power tools, we'll say skill saws and table saws. It's really helpful if you're teaching people a little bit of the house so that they don't cut their fingers off. That's really useful. But beyond that, the whys, the values and the principles, that's the important stuff. Because if I am the next generation and I've got the values figured out, I've got the whys figured out, I can find a how. And the how's going to be different in the next generation. Okay, we're going to come down to this bottom one here. This is going to be your carry away for the morning. We're going to wrap up. I'd like you to think about the word generous. I'd like you to draw a direct connection there. And it's written here, but it's written in a somewhat complicated way. Generous and generate. That your willingness to give, your generousness, is very possibly the thing that is going to generate some big thing in somebody else. They come from the same root. It's almost like family. And there is a nobility that was always associated with generousness. Think of any words in our English language that share that idea with us? No? Gentry? Those of the elite class? Those of the noble class? Yeah. What? And the elite or noble class were originally those that had the opportunity to give. They had more than they needed, and they were willing to give. Do you and I have more than we need? Of something, of anything? That's the question. And are we willing to be generous with it? Because out of our generosity is generated the next generation's opportunities. There are a lot of G's there. But what is the reverse of that? Think about that. If I choose not to be generous, then what have I thwarted? I've put a bottleneck in what might be generated. I've put a who knows what great thing somebody may do that I invest in, whose life I invest in. I want you to really think about that. We don't know that.
Put money in a bag of garbage and forget about it. You never invest in it.
And it's easy to see that with money. But how many do that with their gifts and their talents? If all of our work, God is a relational being, we are God's kids, therefore we are relational beings, our work has to be relational in order, in order for us to do it well, and if that is all true, then even our giving has to be relational. It's better for you to give your life than to give your money. Giving part of your life will make more of a difference than giving a check. Sometimes both are necessary.